So as Chris said, is it love? As Chris said, tonight we'll continue our series on greed, aversion, and delusion. From a Buddhist perspective, these three roots underlie most of our unskillful behavior and underlie also a vast majority of our suffering. But these three roots don't just appear out of nowhere. They have a lot of conditions and causes that lead to their arising. They can be related to our biology, our genetics, our predispositions, our upbringing. But at their root is a very simple reactivity that comes from whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. If something is pleasant, we like it and we want it. And if we get that thing, we think having it is even better, so we really want it. We cling to it. And that's where a lot of our greedy mind states come from, that very simple movement from pleasant to liking to having and hanging on. If we don't get that thing, then we may get angry, which is the aversive reaction, or we may decide that it wasn't worth having, a kind of a sour grapes reaction, which is the kind of reaction based in delusion. If something is unpleasant, then we don't like it and we don't want it. We want to push it away. And if we have trouble pushing it away, it gets even more complicated and we really don't like that. And that's where a lot of our aversive reactions come from, that kind of movement of mind. If we have trouble getting rid of it, there may be some other reactions to it. Maybe we think that ignoring it is the best idea. Or maybe we have a feeling of helplessness. And those would probably be the reactions of somebody who has a tendency towards the delusional qualities. Or maybe we think changing our focus to something pleasant would be a better idea if we can't get rid of something unpleasant. And that's kind of more the greedy reaction. Or if something is neutral, what tends to happen in that situation is that we react with our most usual habitual tendency. So perhaps we space out, which would be a delusional reaction. Or maybe we start having pleasant fantasies, constructing a great place, being in Tahiti, fantasizing being on the beach in Tahiti. And that would be the greedy reaction. Or we might start thinking about all the things that are wrong with our life, that we're in this really neutral, boring place. That would be the aversive reaction. So a lot of our reactivity is born out of this very simple movement from something being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral to reacting from it. The reactions proliferate, and the vast majority of mind states of greed, hatred, and aversion, greed, aversion, and delusion result. So last week, Jim talked about greed, and this week I will focus on aversion, my specialty. And Chris will talk about delusion next week. So one of the first steps to understanding aversion in our minds is to recognize it. And I sat down as I was preparing to give this talk and wrote out all of the forms of aversion that I could just think of off the top of my head, the ones that come up in my mind. And here's the list I came up with. Fear, anger, bitterness, resentment, hostility, dislike, rage, irritation, annoyance, worry, hatred, distrust, cruelty, discontent, frustration, aversion, dissatisfaction, loneliness, resistance. And then I went to the thesaurus and looked up even more. And I got these from the thesaurus. Loathing, disapproval, disgust, fury, disrespect, disparagement, contempt, humiliation, unkindness, meanness, spitefulness, disdain, disquiet, anxiety, apprehension, dread, distress. So there's a huge range of aversive mind states, from the very subtle to the quite obvious. Boredom is also a manifestation of aversion. It's a kind of a mind state where something in our environment is just not quite right. Just feels like something is just a little off. Slight amount of dissatisfaction with the current situation. And then there were two other mind states I thought of that I experience a lot as aversion, and those are impatience and discontent. But as I thought about these, they really can come from either side. They can either be a greedy reaction or an aversive reaction. So impatience would be an aversive reaction if we're impatient to get over something that's unpleasant, something that's happening in our life that's unpleasant, or something that we think is not worth our time. So for me, riding on a plane qualifies in this category. Or if we're impatient to get something that we expect to be pleasant, like when I was a child, Christmas, I was impatient in awaiting Christmas because I was expecting it to be pleasant. So impatience can be a manifestation of either greed or aversion. Discontent is kind of similar, where we may have a reaction of discontent to a situation if we feel like, if only X, Y, and Z were not in this situation, it would be great. That's the aversive reaction. Or we might feel like, oh, if only X, Y, and Z were here, this situation would be great. And that's the greedy reaction. So when we feel the aversive mind states, most of us probably experience them as unpleasant. They're actually, they're suffering in and of themselves. And we probably want to get rid of them. This can add to the suffering, this feeling of wanting to get rid of the aversive mind states, or it can also impel us to try to find another way to live our lives. So what is aversion? There's kind of different roles it can play in our lives. And I thought I'd just review a few of those that I've been familiar with. And one of those is that aversion is a kind of reactivity. It's often a reaction to the unpleasant, as I mentioned earlier. The Buddha was talking to his monks one day, and he said, when a man experiences an unpleasant sensation, actually he said, when an uninstructed worldling experiences an unpleasant sensation, he weeps and wails and beats his breast and laments and grieves. And he said, it is as if this man had been struck by a dart and then added another dart to it. So this is essentially a story of reactivity. What the Buddha is saying is that we will have unpleasant experience in our lives. There's no way to avoid it. We have a body, and it's designed to experience pain if it gets damaged. So we're going to experience pain in our lives. But what the Buddha said is that second dart is the reactivity to that. It's not necessary. That reactivity is not necessary. So, for example, if you cut yourself with a knife, there's the pain of having the cut. And as I said, that's just going to happen because you have a body. But then if you add self-criticism to it, if you start thinking, how could I be so stupid because the knife slipped. I should have known where the knife was going to slip when I cut myself. That's like adding the second dart. It adds more suffering to the situation to have that reaction. And a lot of us don't even stop there. We get angry because we're being critical with ourselves. We hate ourselves because we're angry with ourselves. And we feel sad because we hate ourselves. We can end up cycling and cycling through reactivity over reactivity over reactivity. When we stop and pay attention to our aversion to the situation, our mindfulness can be a very powerful place where we can see that point of reactivity, where we can see how we leave the situation and leap into the reaction. And in that moment, seeing that gap is a place where we can really experience a lot of freedom. We can choose to not go to the reactivity. Another way that aversion manifests itself in our lives is as a form of clinging. And when I first heard this, I was a little confused. I first heard this on my second retreat, and the teacher read from a sutta. And he read a story about Anandapitaka, who was a lay patron of the monk, of the Buddha. And he was very sick and asked the Buddha to send him somebody to cheer him up. So the Buddha sent Shariputra, and Shariputra came and said, "I hope you're feeling better, Anandapitaka." And Anandapitaka's reply was, "Venerable Shariputra, I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Just as if a strong man were splitting my head open with a sharp sword, so too violent winds cut through my head. Just as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife, so too violent winds are carving up my belly." Shariputra's response to this is basically, don't cling, he says. You should train thus. I will not cling to the body. I will not cling to tangibles. I will not cling to body consciousness. I will not cling to body contact. I will not cling to feeling born of body contact. There's actually two pages here of things Shariputra says you shouldn't cling to. And when I heard this, I was a little confused because I thought, if it felt like my head were being split open with a sharp sword, the last thing I would do is cling to it. So I was wondering, what did it mean? What did he mean? Don't cling to your body and your sensations of feeling when there's painful sensations. So on retreat, I had plenty of time to look at this. I was experiencing a lot of aversion on this retreat. And I started seeing what the mind was doing in this, in the aversion. And I discovered that I was clinging. And what I was clinging to was not this. Not this. So often with aversion, we cling to some idea that things should be other than they are. And when we discover this, we recognize that this clinging contributes to our suffering. To have this idea and believe things should be different than they are greatly contributes to our suffering. Another way that aversion can manifest itself in our lives is with a kind of a fix-it mentality. We think, I can fix this or I can change this. And this can actually be a source of really positive feelings and positive results in our lives. When we feel like something is wrong with the situation, and we make a change and it improves, there's a sense of control, there's a sense of accomplishment. And this can be a really powerful motivator for us, for good, actually. There can be a very powerful motivation for us to change things that we feel are wrong. But we need to take care in this kind of a situation that the motivation, the underlying motivation, or at least to notice, I guess, because we can't always control these things, but to notice if the underlying motivation is anger or hatred at the thing, as opposed to wisdom. The desire to change something can come as a motivation out of wisdom, or it could potentially come out of a motivation of anger or hatred. We can often feel justified in our anger when we think it's for a good cause or when we feel like we're right. That rightness can sort of feel like, well, of course the anger is also right. Gil likes to say that when you're right and you're angry, it's like gasoline in a match, that they just serve to combust and explode into this huge conflagration. The reactivity can really cycle very quickly when there's a sense of being right that goes with the anger. It's possible to recognize the need for change and to fix things without hating them. And seeing this possibility can open our eyes to new ways of acting in the world. One of the Buddha's most famous verses is from the Dhammapada. Hatred is never overcome by hatred. By love alone is hatred conquered. This is eternal law. So why do we do it? Why do we continue responding in this way when it's so clearly unpleasant and adds so much suffering? There's several reasons why we might do it. One is that aversion can function as a signal that something is wrong, that it needs to be attended to. It can have a kind of a protective nature to it. So aversion probably has its roots in our biology, where the fact that we have a physical body means that it experiences hunger. It has pain when it's damaged. And we naturally want to fix or avoid these situations. And maybe there's even a kind of a Darwinian explanation for the existence of aversion, where the existence of those mind states results in people who make changes in their world or avoid situations that increases the likelihood of survival. So aversion has some kind of very basic functions in our life. We also might have patterns of emotional responses that were skillful once in a particular context, but aren't necessarily so skillful in another context. I know myself, as well as other friends of mine, find themselves stuck in some patterns that were created in childhood that aren't necessarily so applicable now. Another way that aversion can get a hold of us is when our sense of identity is threatened. We have a very strong sense of ownership about a feeling of who we are, and we can get very protective about that. It can feel dangerous almost if somebody threatens that sense of identity. Sometimes I think we're more attached to our identities than we are to our bodies. And we can have the very strong feeling of needing to protect that if it's threatened. And Chris, I think, will talk a lot more about identification and the sense of self next week. So Buddhist psychology has a theory of personality types that basically breaks people into three types based on their reactivity. And no big surprise, there's the greedy type, the aversive type, and the deluded type. And the three different types can be illustrated by a simple story. And that's, if you walk into a room, what is your first reaction to the room? If you come into this room, for instance, if you have a greedy type of personality, you would probably be drawn to the things that are pleasant. You might notice, oh, what a beautiful statue, or what nice flowers, nice spaciousness in this room. As an aversive type, you might walk into the room and notice everything that you don't like about it. Oh, I don't like the way my socks stick to this carpet. And there's too many people in here. There's not enough space. And the walls are so plain. Why don't they put some art on it? Or if you have more of a tendency towards the delusional type, you might not notice much about the room itself. You might just be kind of in your own world, or you might be a little confused. What's going on here? What are we supposed to be doing? How do I fit in? So I definitely tend towards the aversive side myself. And for me, it was helpful to know about these personality types and just recognize these kinds of reactions, these kind of tendencies that I had towards aversion and anger, as just one of the ways that people respond to things. Unskillfully, albeit, but just one of the ways that people respond to things. So for me, it was helpful to see that a lot of what I do is simply a reaction to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So I thought I'd talk for just a little bit about what the world looks like from an aversive perspective. So as an aversive, aversives tend to focus on the unpleasant. We're drawn to the unpleasant, in fact. One time, Gil was giving me a guided meditation where he suggested that I just let my mind kind of wander and land arbitrarily on sensations in my body. And once it found one, just to recognize it, let go, then find another, and another, and another, and another. And what I noticed in this meditation was that almost every sensation I landed on was unpleasant. It was some way, something wasn't good about it. The flip side of this is that the aversives don't tend to see the positive things so much. The joy, the happiness, they're not taken so seriously, or they may not even be noticed at all. Or if they are noticed, they're kind of pushed aside or seen as not so important. Another story I have on one retreat, I was experiencing a lot of calm at one point, and my reaction to this calm, I had to laugh at myself when I saw it, was, oh, calm, this feels so good. So there was a little bit of reactivity there. You could see, this is nice. The next thing that my mind did with it was, this is the perfect time to pay attention to that pain in my back. Because my mind is so calm, I could be with my pain. So that's the aversive will tend to do that. Another way that the aversive might react to the environment is a kind of a scanning to look. Where's the next threat coming from? Maybe there's nothing wrong, but just kind of this, what's out there? What do I need to worry about? Aversives tend to get stuck to things they don't like. Because we focus on the unpleasant and we think we can fix them, it's like we get glued to things trying to figure out how to get rid of them. Oh, if I could just change it here or do that or do that. It's really getting stuck to this thing trying to figure out how to get rid of it. We actually cling to unpleasant things trying to get rid of them. The personality type of aversion is one who has a habitual tendency towards aversion. The mind has a groove, and it wants to get stuck in that groove. So I had a clear example of seeing how the mind inclined towards aversion and anger. One time I was cutting an apple, and in cutting the apple, there was a connection with the memory of a friend of mine. And we had been in at a fruit stand. And so that was the connection, the memory to the apple. And this particular person, I had a very long history of getting extremely angry at. And as soon as that memory arose with him in it, I saw the mind incline towards getting angry. I saw there was kind of this almost leaning into that thought with the intention to get angry at him. And I recognized it. I recognized that inclination. And I saw that I didn't have to go there. I actually saw that point of reactivity and that choice point. And I let it go, and I didn't get angry. And this was a really important recognition for me that was possible. So how do we practice with aversion? When I was first, before I started practicing mindfulness, one of the things I used to do with my anger was to take a tennis racket and hit my bed. And that does help release some of the physical energy. The aversive states tend to gather a lot of energy in the body. And that hitting my bed with the tennis racket helped release some of that physical energy. But over time, I found that it didn't do much for the anger. It actually you know, even while I was hitting the bed, there was kind of a sense of anger in the body, of you know, the repetition of what I was angry about was somehow being fed. In mindfulness, we practice a middle way with respect to our aversive mind states. We don't repress them, but nor do we express them. We try not to deny them, but nor do we act them out. We try to simply let the emotion live its own life in our body with mindfulness, with awareness and attention. And I have found that this is actually the best way to let the aversion lose its power. It really, the power dispels with the mindfulness. So as we learn to bring mindfulness to our aversion, one of the first things that's helpful to do is to take our attention away from the object of aversion. So typically, for instance, in anger, we're angry at someone. And all of our attention is out there, focused on that person. What he said to me, why it was wrong, what I'm going to say to him when I see him next, how I need to protect myself from it happening again. There's a whole bunch of stories that are out there around that person. But what we're asked to do in mindfulness instead is to turn the attention away from the object of the anger and into the aversion or the anger itself. To have an inward focus instead of an outward focus. And as we do this, we quickly start to learn that aversion itself is unpleasant. And so in aversion, the thing that we're averse to and the aversion are both unpleasant. And this can make paying attention to aversion a little difficult at first. But we also learn pretty quickly that when we start to pay attention to aversion with mindfulness, that the quality of suffering really shifts, that actually there's a lot less suffering around the aversion when we're paying attention to it with mindfulness. And we see this as a road out of our suffering. It's as we start to see this, it's a really strong incentive to practice mindfulness when we can see that the mindfulness really diminishes the quality of suffering around the aversion. As in the example of the cutting of the apple, really seeing that moment where I had the choice to not go into the aversion, and I experienced in that moment the freedom from the suffering that would have been there had I not been mindful. It really clearly shows us the power of mindfulness and is a very strong incentive to practice. So there's three basic components to any emotion, and all of these aversive mind states are emotions. There's the emotion itself, the emotional mood or tone in the mind, which can kind of be likened to colored lenses that get put on, just a slight different view to the world. There's the thoughts or the story. And then there's the physical sensations in the body. And almost every emotion has some kind of physical manifestation. So with these three aspects, we can be mindful with any of these three areas. So first, the emotion itself. Simply recognizing the emotion we're having can be really powerful. And that's part of the reason why I named them before, just to give you an idea of all of these different flavors of emotions: bitterness, resentment, loneliness, frustration, anger, hatred, irritation. All of these things, if we can recognize them, the simple recognition of the mind state can be very powerful to help free us from being hooked to it. And sometimes it's very easy to see what the mind state is, what the emotional tone or in the mind is. Other times it's not so clear. And sometimes then it's helpful to, I wouldn't say actually go into the story so much, but kind of pay attention a little bit to the flavor of the story or the thoughts in the mind. So, for instance, aversion has the story, not this. I don't like this. I don't want this. I need to get rid of this. Fear has the story, what if this bad thing happens? And there's a kind of a sense of playing things out into the future. Irritation has the story, they shouldn't have done that. And anger is probably an even stronger version of that. You've done me wrong. You're wrong. I'm right. And an excessive sense of replaying the past. But I do want to caution you in terms of paying attention to the thoughts. It's very easy to get caught into the content of the thoughts. And so aside from a little bit of help figuring out what the emotion is if you're having trouble figuring it out, it's best, actually, if you can let go of the story as much as possible. We often get caught in the story of aversion. One of the best ways to let go of the story is to turn the attention into the body, to feel how the emotion is manifest in the bodily sensations. You may experience a whole range of bodily sensations. These mind states tend to have a very energetic quality to them, and that energy is felt somewhere in the body. So anger, for instance, has a feeling perhaps of heat up in this area, in the chest, or tension, maybe a flushing in the face or a clenching in the hands. Fear may have a sense of contraction in the abdomen. Just explore in the body what sensations are present when you're feeling the emotion. So the sensations in the body are not the story, and they are in the present moment. So you can know that you're within the present moment if you're paying attention to the bodily sensations connected with the emotion. But I do want to caution you to be clear that the bodily sensations are not the emotion itself. So if you're using the noting, for example, if you've noticed fear and you were noting fear, and then decide to turn and explore in the body and start noticing the contraction in your abdomen, don't keep noting fear. You're paying attention to bodily sensations, so note the sensations. Note the contraction, note the tension, note the pulling. Note those sensations. This does a couple of things. It helps to disengage us from being hooked to the emotion, and it also clarifies the mindfulness to let you be very clear that you're paying attention to bodily sensations and not the emotion. This has been very important and helpful in my own practice. There was one time where I was waiting for an interview. And I typically, in that situation, get a little bit anxious because I'm going to have to be speaking. I haven't spoken in 3 days, and I have to figure out what I'm going to say to the teacher. And there's just a little bit of anxiety. And in this situation, I was sitting there and feeling the anxiety and was just noting it and was feeling some kind of quivering sensations in the body. And I just kept noting it, anxiety. And the interview ahead of me went on for a long time. So I was doing this for a long time, 5-10 minutes or so. And at some point I realized, wow, this anxiety is really strong. It's just not going away. What is this? And I started paying more close attention to the sensations in the body, to the quivering feeling that was in the body. And what I discovered was that I was experiencing rapture, not anxiety. That the rapture has had a kind of a very energetic sense through the body, and that's what was creating the quivering. And I had taken the context of the situation, the waiting for an interview where I typically experience the anxiety, and assumed that the quivering was a result of the anxiety. So we can be surprised. So it's very helpful if you're experiencing that kind of thing to really attend to the physical sensations. So that's working with the emotions with mindfulness, working with the three components of the of emotions. And then there's some other ways to work with emotions that kind of skirt the edges of mindfulness a little bit, but they've been very helpful for me, so I'd like to go over them with you. And one is recognizing the unpleasant. If you're experiencing an aversive mind state, one of my teachers, Carol Wilson, said, if you're experiencing aversion, there's something unpleasant in your environment. So see if you can find what's unpleasant. Often we're reacting to something and we're averse to something and we don't even know what it is that we're reacting to. So sometimes what we're reacting to is very simple bodily sensation, hunger, a slight headache, an achiness. Or if I'm tired, tiredness is another one. I can find that I get into aversive mind states if these very subtle, unpleasant sensations are in the body. So if there's an unpleasant sensation that's not noticed, it can lead us into reactivity. But there's also the situation where there may be an unpleasant thought that arises in the mind that triggers the reactivity. There was a situation on my first 3-month retreat where I was doing walking meditation. And as I was doing walking meditation, somebody came up right next to me and started walking next to me. And I experienced this intense aversion to this person. And I remembered Carol's instruction, look for the unpleasant. And so I started looking. What? Okay, so what's unpleasant here? And there wasn't anything in the 5 senses I could find that was unpleasant. You know, the person didn't look unpleasant or they didn't smell unpleasant or I wasn't touching them. So, you know, there wasn't that aspect of a problem. So I thought, well, there must be some thought in the mind. So I started paying attention to what thoughts might be arising. To that point, I hadn't particularly noticed any thoughts. I thought I was being mindful of my walking. So I started trying to pay attention to thoughts. And after a few passes, I noticed the thought come up, he's weird. And I thought, oh, that's a thought. And at that point, I didn't really see the connection. So I just kept walking, and a few minutes later, there was this kind of explosion in the mind where this thought was, he's in bare feet and it's freezing cold outside. And I recognized that the mind had created this feeling of the story that this person was weird and was reacting to it. It really had no basis so much in the present moment. It was all a construct of the mind, and the thought was unpleasant. Actually, there was probably a little fear around the thought that was unpleasant. And that reactivity is what triggered the aversion. As soon as I saw it, all the aversion dropped away. So seeing the unpleasant, I have found to be one of the best ways to work with aversion. Notice what it is that you're reacting to. If aversion is strong or difficult to be with, if you find your mind kind of bouncing off the aversion or getting sucked into the story in strong rage, for example, or anger, it can help to move your attention to something neutral, to the feelings of your feet on the floor, to your butt on the chair, the feelings of your hands, for example. We do cultivate the breathing as a place that's neutral. But often in angry or aversive reactions, there's some kind of tension in the torso that may affect the breathing. And so it can kind of trigger us to go back into the anger if we're trying to pay attention to the breathing. So I found it helpful to cultivate something away from the center of the body. The feet, the hands, as a place of kind of refuge, a neutral place to rest the mind when I can't stay with the aversive sensation, feeling. So one story I have of this is my practice actually began, I was motivated to start the practice through very strong anger at a person. And over time, I was noticing that I was very reactive to this anger. It was really hard to be with. And so what would happen, what I did, what I decided to do when the anger came up is to just say, I recognized I wasn't able to be mindful of it, that I would get pulled into it. And so I would just recognize and say, you know, this is not productive, not now. I'll come back to this sometime when I'm able, when my mindfulness has gotten stronger. This was still pretty early in my practice, so I thought my mindfulness will get stronger at some point. I'll be able to look at this. And so I just said, not now, and put it aside and went to something neutral. I went to my feet walking or my butt sitting in the chair. And over time, what happened is that the anger started coming up less and less. I just did this over and over again. Not now, not now, not now. Come to something neutral. And over time, it started. The anger started getting farther and further apart. It didn't happen every day, or then even every week, or even every month. This was over the course of several years. And then one day, I recognized, where did that anger go? I haven't felt that in a long time. What happened to it? And I kind of checked in my body. Where is it? And even the thought of this person in my mind didn't create the anger. And I thought, wow, maybe it's gone. And I didn't particularly trust it at that point. But it had actually disappeared. I have not had that come back. It's been, I think, about 5 years since that anger disappeared. So this attending to something neutral, I never had to go back and actually face it directly. Simply feeling it, saying, oh, there's the anger, and letting it go. It's like just doing that over and over again was enough to let it process over a long period of time. Neutral experience can come as a huge relief to somebody in an aversive mind state. So it is helpful to cultivate something neutral in your experience. And for me, initially, this was much easier than doing the traditional practice for aversion, which is the Brahmaviharas. That's the typical antidote to aversive mind states, the four Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes. They are metta, or loving kindness, karuna, or compassion, mudita, or sympathetic joy, and upekkha, or equanimity. And what the commentaries say is that loving kindness counteracts ill will, compassion counteracts cruelty, mudita, sympathetic joy, counteracts discontent, and equanimity counteracts the aversion in general. And I found this to be very challenging initially, the practice of metta. One of my teachers, Guy Armstrong, talks about metta as being like a magnet that we run over our hearts that pulls out everything that's not metta, and we get to experience it. So in doing the metta practice, a lot of anger can come up, a lot of difficulty, a lot of hatred, a lot of aversion can come up. And sometimes it's very hard to be with, and you need to just go back to the mindfulness. And that's what I had to do for several years. So for me, working with these Brahmaviharas has taken a number of years before I could actually approach them. So what I'll close with is talking a little bit about the positive side, what happens through the transformation of aversion. And in another part of this theory of personality types in Buddhist psychology is that all of these types transform through the practice. So the greedy type transforms into someone who's more motivated by love. The aversive type has a strong capacity for discriminative wisdom. And the delusional type has the capacity for spaciousness and equanimity, very strong capacity for equanimity. So through the practice of mindfulness, aversion is transformed into discriminative wisdom. So how does this happen? Aversion is a really unpleasant mind state. And those of us who spend a lot of time in aversion experience a lot of suffering. And the First Noble Truth comes as no surprise to us. We're very familiar with suffering. When we become motivated to understand our suffering, we quickly begin to see that when we start to see the aversion with mindfulness, with wisdom, the suffering changes. We see the other noble truths. We see how we contribute to our suffering through the clinging around the aversion. We begin to see the release from it, and we start to see the path to the end of suffering through the practice. So in this way, aversion is transformed from a reactivity to suffering to the clear understanding of suffering, which is where the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths comes in. So those are my thoughts on aversion, and I just wanted to open it up to any comments or any questions or discussion. Anybody have anything to say in their own practice about how they've worked with aversion? Yeah.
With your anger and how you use neutral states and in trying to say to yourself, not now,
yes,
later, and how much that helped you. The thought that came to my mind was, it's a very delicate balance for me recognizing when I'm telling myself, not now, just labeling emotions later, and when I'm not repressing.
Yes.
And doing that, then I'm not really looking into what is the emotion telling me and what I learned from that emotion.
That's true. Yes, that's very true. And in terms of distinguishing between them, I think there's a sense, I think, in the when you're pushing it away, that there's a feeling, there is a feeling of pushing it away. It's not a simple, not now. There is a feeling in the body of resistance that I think we need to cultivate an awareness of that in order to distinguish between the two. Because you're right, if I had been letting it go with the I don't want to see this, I think it would not have had the same effect over time.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think.
Does anybody else have any thoughts about how you might distinguish the two? For me, it's kind of a subtle bodily sensation.
Just thinking that the important thing maybe is that there's a moment of clearly recognizing it and accepting it. You know, and you're aware that you're feeling it, and that you accept. You don't have to feel, I'm not a person who gets angry. You know, you can feel that, yeah, that's really what's happening, and then you can say not now, versus going right into the not now.
So there's an element of acceptance.
Yeah, the element of acceptance. Just give it a few moments, you know.
I think that's true. That sense of letting yourself be with it for a second, where there is that sense. Yeah, that sounds right.
I really like your phrase, discriminative wisdom. I think it sounds like I could see it when it was there, but can you say some more about it? How do you know what's just simple out and out aversive judgment?
Again, I think
you're right or not.
Well, again, I think it has something to do with the feeling in the body. And, you know, Tan Jeff the other day says, experimentation is a lot of this, you know, to begin to see based on how things come out, or whether it truly is wisdom or whether it is a judgment. It's a touchy place. Let me think about it for a moment.
How attached are you to whether you're right or not? You know? Because discriminating wisdom sees it. You know, but if then later on something else comes up that contradicts it, well, it sees that. You know, it wasn't attached to that perception as being know, an important example of you being right. It has nothing to do with being right, it's just the truth of what you saw in that moment.
So one way to tell would be how easily you can let go of whatever the conclusion is.
And it may, that may take a while before you see that. Yeah.
Is that sense of being right the story?
There's usually a story behind it, but there is kind of this feeling that it comes with to me. There's kind of, it's almost an emotion itself, that sense of right, I'm right. So to me, that has a flavor of being an emotion itself, but there's almost always a story there. There's kind of a sense of, so it's a sense of solidity. It's actually a sense of self around that feeling of being right.
And if that sort of can be construed as the emotion, an emotion itself, how does one look for that in the body? Because it's not like anger or heat or fear. I mean, it seems to be have a different texture to it, and I'm not sure where you find it.
Yeah, some of these things can be very subtle in the body. Again, it's something that you can see over time. You know, if you start to just pay attention in your body when you feel this kind of thing, this feeling of I'm right, if you pay attention in your body, over time you'll start seeing the consistencies that give you the sense of, oh, this is what this being feeling right is like, this sense in the body, that over time you'll begin to understand it. Some of these things are very subtle in the body. So it's really kind of teasing apart the sensations that you find and finding the kind of more consistent set of sensations over time. Does that make any sense?
Yes, and I'm just not to relay this, but as an example of how subtle can you, how can you begin to, not necessarily with this, but if they are subtle bodily sensations, how do you start?
Well, one thing you can do is just kind of, particularly in the area of the chest, emotions are very strongly felt here. And if you can just let yourself feel what's happening here when you attend to the bodily sensations, this is probably the place to start.
So you go looking this way.
You can, yeah. If it's subtle, you can go looking. I mean, it's not strict mindfulness. But I have definitely found some techniques that were not strict mindfulness to be extremely helpful. So if I find that I'm caught in something like this sense of rightness and need something like the body, I go looking. Yeah. Yeah. It may not be so obvious, but I do go looking.
For me, when I experience something that feels extreme here, I have to make a decision to sit with it. And it's not me. Like if I know this is fear and it's starting to affect my body, like I'll start shaking and my stomach will get butterflies or something. That to me is a signal to sit and be with that for me. And then I start to recognize I have to make that cognitive realization that this is a mind state. This is not something that's permanent. And it's not something that can hurt me. It's just something passing through me. And then I have to go to the next step and say, this is not mine. This is the experience that we all have when we're afraid to one degree or another. And then the mind state passes. And then I'm okay. And I notice that my body calms down. You know, I kind of am more present and realizing that that which I'm fearing is not happening right now. So it's kind of freeing. It's over.
That's great. That's really what you described is probably one of the most I find to be joyful aspects of the practice, where you can actually ride an emotion out and see that we aren't defined by them and we aren't hooked to them, that they can just arise and pass. It's really, it's a great thing. And once it's happened a few times, it really, I feel like it's given me the incentive to keep doing it.
Excuse me, it makes me feel, when I start to move into the bodily sensation and the bodily reaction to the fear or whatever the emotion is, again, I get very intellectual about it and think, I know what the consequence of this is, and I don't want to go there. I know how this moves me into stress. I know how it will wreck my afternoon, and I don't want to go there, I don't have to. And that's a big piece of freedom for me. I don't have to. I can just watch the state go away, let it disappear, enjoy the calmness that follows. And it feels like a huge liberation.
That's great. Yeah, your reflection that you did is one of the ones the Buddha recommends for unwholesome mind states, to reflect on the unpleasant consequences of the unwholesome mind state. So that's great. Yeah. Thank you.